Oh my gosh, Cameron, I've got this amazing collection of pens. I've got some awesome ones from the Nintendo store. I've got a couple from downtown Tokyo. You have got to check these out.
Okay. So what do you got there?
Get this one. This one's really cool. Here, check it out. See how it clicks? Doesn't it sound awesome?
Yeah, that's a pretty nice click, but I don't really get it. What are you doing with all these pens?
Oh, hold on. I got this other one too. Isn't this awesome?
Jake, why do you have all these pens?
Oh, well, hey, Cameron, you told me this was the ultimate pen episode.
No, Jake, I said this was the penultimate episode.
Wait, what?
Hello and welcome back, everyone, to the penultimate episode of Region Unlocked. And if you need a vocabulary lesson, that means it's the second to last. My name's Cameron.
And my name's Jake, and I just learned a new word today.
Is there a Japanese word for penultimate?
Penultimate. Well, I don't know the word for penultimate, but I know the word for last, which is saigo. So saigo no episodo. The last episode.
But this isn't the last. Second to last.
So second to last is saigo janai, not last. I don't know. Second to last. It's an obscure word I need to look up.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
I'll do that right now.
All right. While I do that, we're recording today on April 6th and April 7th, 2024. If you are just now listening to this podcast for the first time ever, it's about me and Jake.
Hello.
We're good friends. Best friends, you might say. Except I live in the U.S., he lives in Japan, and we talk about video games to stay connected. And we have a great time.
Yes, we do. It's pretty awesome. And I just got the translation right here. Saigo kara ni banme.
Okay.
Saigo kara ni banme means penultimate, second to last.
There you go.
So yeah, there you go. A little second to last language lesson there for everyone as well.
Jake's Japanese lesson jingle! Here we are, very close to the end. It's an interesting feeling. We've been doing this for a while, but you know what? Let's save the sentimentality for the next episode. And instead, let's just talk about what we've been up to. We have not recorded a lot this season, as you know. The last episode that we recorded with Aaron, where he was here for indie games, we had a great time, but that was the only thing we recorded up until now of this year, and we have just been so busy. So, Jake, let's catch up a bit. What notable things have you been up to?
Yeah, I'd say there's been quite a bit. I'm not just going to say that it's been work and sleeping, because it's been a lot of exploring, playing games, and doing exciting things. I will say that on top of the already very interesting commutes that I have during work, I did take some time off where I could spend some time. We went to rural Japan and kind of visited some traditional areas, and I got to have some awesome experiences walking around villages that are known for their pottery. And I actually got to try some pottery out, throwing on the wheel, and make some of that. And that was really cool because I hadn't done that since high school, and I loved it so much. So I got to make some traditional pottery.
That's cool.
Traditional style pottery.
Do you have some with you that I can see?
Unfortunately, I don't right now, because what happens is you pay a certain fee, you get a certain amount of time with the help of a professional at the wheel, and then when you're finished, they fire it up for you and glaze it for you, and then they ship it to you. So that'll take like about a month or so. So unfortunately, I don't have it with me, but I will soon, and when I do, I'll have to show it to you then.
Okay.
But I made it, tried to make some functional bowls, but yeah, that's something fun that I did, and got to really explore the most recent thing, which is the fact that it's now spring in Japan.
Mm, beautiful time.
Absolutely beautiful time. You were here around this time last year.
I know. I can't believe it's already been a year.
Yeah.
I miss it so much, and We're going back at the end of May, and oh my gosh, I can't wait. And I hate that it's been a year already, but I feel like I still remember it so fresh. So go on, how's the spring?
It's been wonderful. And one thing I'm kind of kicking myself about right now is I should have taken you guys to one particular place that I was not really aware of when it was this time last year. So as everyone knows, Japan is known for its cherry blossoms or sakura trees. Mm-hmm. And there are hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of them just dotting the city. And they all bloom at around the same time for only a few days. And it is beautifully beyond breathtaking. It's not something you can capture in photos as much as I've tried and as much as people do.
Yeah.
You might see examples of it like on Instagram. It does not capture the beauty of seeing up close. And they are in full bloom right now during this weekend. It was supposed to rain, but thankfully it didn't. So yesterday I went to the nearby Kogane Park, mm-hmm. which is one of the top, I guess, four places to view these in Tokyo and by extension, maybe Japan. There is a sea, and I am saying this figuratively, of course, a sea of just pink, white tree canopies that are just dotting the entire park. I took some pictures, but when I took you guys there last year, it was dark out.
We couldn't see it.
But it is so beautiful. I cannot believe it. I just sat there, looked at it, took pictures, and I'm using this to shamelessly plug Japan to come visit around this time. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even that busy, which is the best part. So come and see the sakura trees. It is the type of beauty that you cannot take pictures of, only witness for your own eyes.
Well, send some of those my way. Let's throw them on the Instagram so some other people can see them.
For sure.
I'll talk about this more next week as we kind of look back over the course of this podcast and trying to promote. But I don't like social media. And if you follow us on Instagram, we do not post often, but we'll try to post more. But man, it's can be tedious sometimes. But anyway, cool.
Yeah.
So what else?
I guess I've been trying to play some more games because I have not had that much time to play them. And I've also been doing some more exploring in downtown Tokyo as well, which has been really nice. I've been trying some new foods.
Yeah.
I guess the coolest part about that is I've been cooking a lot more and I've been learning some traditional Japanese cuisine. And that's been a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. What has been your favorite to make?
So I've started small, or I should say not small, but started more simply. And I just tried to make some fried rice, which got some very good reviews, by the way. throw in some good little bits of meat, little bits of veggies, and pepper some stuff in. And then I tried my hand at some omurice, which, if you don't know what that is, it's a bed of rice with an omelet on top.
Oh, okay.
Omelet rice, omurice.
Oh.
So that was a little more tricky for me, but I did do it, and it was quite delicious, I must say. So that's also a very great meal to have in Japan, is omurice, if you ever get the chance to. I also got to visit Osaka a few days ago,
yeah,
which was wonderful. And I got to visit Osaka Castle and see some of the just barely budding sakura trees at the time. Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure they're a lot more filled out right now, but it was so nice to get some wonderful views and panoramic pictures of the entire castle. And of course, Osaka is a little more traditional than Tokyo, so there's mm-hmm. a lot more fun places to see. And it was just really colorful and great to go back there because that's like my second home in Japan.
Yeah.
Some of you probably remember, if you've been a veteran listener, for a while I lived in Osaka and had to record there. And apparently that was the best sound quality I had.
Yeah, because you actually were in like a closet and you put up like some foam pads around you.
Yeah, it was like my little studio. So I had a traditional style apartment, and traditional style apartments have huge closets in Japan. They're massive because they were meant to hold all the bedding and basically everything because there's not a lot of space here. So you could turn it into a separate room. Like, I kid you not.
Huh.
It was wonderful.
Nice.
Yeah, so got to visit Osaka, and I took the Shinkansen.
Of course. That's one place I'm very excited to go back to, because when we were there a year ago, we only really just kind of stopped in Osaka to go to Super Nintendo World at Universal, and then the next day we're on our way to Kyoto. So very excited to actually spend time there. We've got a food tour booked for our first night there. And I've heard it's like the kitchen of the world. It's just so much delicious food there. So I cannot wait.
Absolutely. The highest concentration of Michelin-rated restaurants outside of, I believe, France is in Osaka.
No way. That's awesome.
Something like that. Japan has a really high percentage compared to many other countries.
Yeah. That's not surprising.
The cuisine in Osaka is amazing. Oh, yeah. And I did go to another little mom and pop shop where we got some okonomiyaki. Just kind of walk into this dingy little place that's probably been there for 70 years and had some of the best okonomiyaki I've ever had. That's the vibe you get in Osaka.
And could you describe what that is?
The dingy little shop?
The food.
Oh, okonomiyaki? Well, first off, the dingy little shop was owned by the nicest little woman. She was so kind to me. But anyway, the food, okonomiyaki, it's like a savory pancake of veggies, meats, egg, rice, all put together. It's like a whole meal kind of put together, made in front of you, like a pancake, essentially. But it's not sweet. It's savory.
Okay.
And it is, to date, one of my favorite Japanese foods of all time. And the cool thing about okonomiyaki is it has a very, very different composition and flavor depending on where you are in Japan.
Okay.
So very, very regional. Tokyo style is not even like, doesn't look a thing like Osaka style. So it's interesting. Yeah. Okonomiyaki.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, you told me about this a while ago, but you haven't told the Regionaires. What has your experience been recently with Hello Kitty?
Hello Kitty. Okay, this is an interesting one. Thank you for bringing this up. So my company, we're an educational company, and we recently partnered with Sanrio to kind of get their new program started, which is an English program. And they created a whole new cast of characters and, you know, whole new mini anime series based around this. And they've put so many resources into it. And I was part of the team that kind of flagshipped these lessons. So because I had experience and because they wanted to showcase this to the shareholders and all the executives of the company, they were like, Jake, we wanted you to do something special. We want you to give this English lesson to the CEO of our company. And I just kind of looked at them like, what did you just ask me? I almost didn't understand what they were saying. But they were very, very calm about it because – you know, it's just, I don't know, probably didn't want to make a big deal about it. I was kind of shaking the whole time up until the second that this guy popped up on screen. Just a normal, really good guy. Just a nice guy. He spoke English, but I didn't know who he was at first because they told me, okay, before we do this actual lesson, we're going to have a mock lesson just to make sure all of the equipment is correct and that all the tech stuff works. So they actually did not have a mock lesson prior to that.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there waiting for the call to start. And this guy comes on and he's answering my questions in English because I'm giving this like kind of fun little trial lesson in English. And as soon as he gives the right answer, I hear this barrage of like dozens of people behind him go, oh, and then I thought like, oh, okay, with this many like, you know, yes, men, I'm pretty sure that's the executive that I'm talking to. It was hilarious. Like, he'd answer a really easy question, like, how are you? I am fine. Oh, a whole bunch of people in the background just applauding and saying, like, so yeah, I apparently just gave a lesson to the CEO of the company and didn't even know it. He was a really nice guy. And yeah, that was hopefully a very positive experience for the executives. And apparently the entire board of directors was there to witness this behind the scenes. But yeah, that to this date, I guess the CEO of Sanrio Corporation is my most prolific teaching, prolific student that I've ever had.
That's crazy. Like, how many people can say that? That they taught to a CEO of a famous, is Hello Kitty anime? What is Hello Kitty? Or is it just a franchise?
It's an IP, it's a franchise.
Yeah, an IP, there you go.
Yeah, and Hello Kitty is, of course, very recognizable. You probably know what that is, and it is part of this company, Sanrio. And they're known for creating these like really cutesy characters and like creating whole shows and, you know, universes and products around them.
Right. That's pretty sweet.
It was. It was cool.
Well done. Well done. I'm proud of you.
Thank you. K-I-T-T-Y! K-I-T-T-Y! Everybody say Hello Kitty! Who loves flowers in the sun or a party just for one? It's Kitty, Kitty, Kitty. Who will invite her friends along? They can hear her play a song. It's Kitty, Kitty, Kitty. If you don't know where she lives, you might have missed her and her papa and her mama. All right, Cameron, what about you? I want to hear what you've been up to.
I got so much to tell you. Let's back up. I've told you this, but let's talk to the fans here, the Regionaires. I have met a few famous people this year, and it's been pretty fun. So the first one, this is back in January, around my birthday, and I live, Midwest Indiana, but I live in a pretty good-sized town. But in the Midwest, in Indiana, there's much, much smaller towns. On the middle of nowhere called Seeger. And this high school has this separate kind of, I don't know if it's their main auditorium or something, but it's separate from the high school. And it's really nice. It's this place to have shows and I guess screen movies. But still, it's out in the middle of nowhere. Like a bunch of fields. It's the only light in the middle of a bunch of fields. The cast of Napoleon Dynamite was there. All right. So John Heder, who plays Napoleon Dynamite, Efren Ramirez, who plays Pedro, and John Grease, who plays Uncle Rico. Unfortunately, Aaron Ruel, I think is his name, who plays Kip, he was not there. But still, we got big three right there. So they come out to the middle of nowhere. They come to do a screening. And then afterwards, come out and do like this hour-long question and answer to the crowd. But beforehand, my dad, for my birthday, had bought the VIP tickets to go in and meet them. So, so me and Lindsay, we get to go in and give all three of them hugs and chat for a minute or two and get our picture. And it was just so weird. It's like these guys just out, they're standing in a high school cafeteria, signing autographs and getting pictures with people. And then we watched the movie, and it was really cool to watch the movie with a bunch of people who find it just as funny as I do. Because it's a weird movie, right?
Yeah.
Some indie nonsense, but it's great. And so we watched it, had a great time. Then they came out, and it was a pretty small audience. So like we were all close to the stage, got to see them, got to ask questions, and it was just a lot of fun. I know for some of you younger listeners, Napoleon Dynamite, hopefully you know of it, but it came out in 2004. So this was a 20-year anniversary, which is weird. But that was such a big deal when I was in middle school. It was quoted all the time. I watched it a lot. And actually, it's one of these core memories between me and my dad, where in middle school, I had started playing drums. He bought me this used drum set, but we had to make it nice. We had to polish it up. And so there's like a week straight where we had every nut and bolt off that drum set and were hand polishing every single one. And while we did that, sat on the living room floor and watched Napoleon Dynamite every day as I worked on polishing up all these nuts and bolts. And I'll never forget that. So really cool. Really cool.
That's so cool.
Take a look at what I'm wearing, people. Do you think anybody wants a roundhouse kick to the face while I'm wearing these bad boys? Forget about it.
But moving on from there, this year I went to the Indiana Comic-Con for the first time. And this is my first convention I've ever gone to. And it was good. Ish, I'll say. I didn't really know what to expect. Have you been to a convention before?
Not a comic convention. Okay. I've been to like smaller ones.
Okay. As I went into it, like I know they have panels where you can sit in and I don't know, listen to people's opinions. None of the panels seemed that interesting to me. I didn't really care about that. Then the main floor is just nothing but merch. It's just buying stuff. But a lot of it I thought was pretty similar. Like all the booths were kind of selling similar things. So I didn't end up buying anything. But the main reason we went there is because they had so many celebrities come to this. I couldn't believe how many big name celebrities they got. Unfortunately, didn't get to meet many of them. But the main draw was none other than Hayden Christensen, aka Anakin Skywalker. And that's a big deal. It was an expensive big deal. So like many of you and myself, but mostly my sister, has been obsessed with him since Attack of the Clones. And my sister especially, she used to watch Revenge of the Sith every day. It was her Napoleon Dynamite. And she could probably quote every word of that movie. She's always been in love with him. I don't blame her. And so I got tickets. I'm like, I'm going to see if Jamie wants to come. So she comes. It's my sister and my wife, Lindsay. And we wait in line for a while. But eventually we got into the little photo booth. And at this point, you guys have seen the pictures on Instagram if you follow. So, yeah. I walked in and I didn't really say much. I just shook his hand. I was like, hey, Hayden. He's like, hey. And my sister was a little more vocal, mostly just saying, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And we take the picture and she's like, oh, I've been waiting 22 years to meet you. And he's just like, oh, yeah, you want a hug? Like, yes. So she got a hug. We got our picture. And then afterwards, we got to meet John Rhys Davies, who plays Gimli in Lord of the Rings, or I believe Zola is his name, and Indiana Jones.
Sala.
Okay. And he was great. So we walk into his photo booth. Lindsay walks in first, and she was just all kind of giddy as she walks in, and he starts being giddy right back to her. And we get up, and she's like, oh, I'm the biggest fan. And, oh, I love this. Because he's tall in real life. He's not a dwarf, if you didn't know that.
Okay.
He's like 6'1", but I'm still taller than that. So she says, I'm the biggest fan. And he looks at me and, like, grabs my shoulder. He's like, no, this is the biggest fan.
Nice.
Yeah, it was awesome. And then he was doing this to, like, everyone getting their picture taken. But he had his arm around Lindsay and Jamie, and it was, like, tickling their ear. And he goes, no giggling. And he was just so funny. He was a delight to meet. So, yep, got to meet Anakin and got to meet Gimli. So,
wow.
5 celebrities within 3 months. That's pretty cool.
That's impressive. That's a wonderful thing.
But, so we're not done yet. At the end of the night, there was a panel with Hayden and Rosario Dawson. She was also there. She plays Ahsoka in the new series. And they did this panel on stage. It was okay. Rosario was great. She was very energetic. Hayden had clearly had an exhausting day, we'll say. And his questions weren't very interesting that they asked him. And okay. As we were leaving, my sister was saying, like, he's been answering these questions for like 20 years. Like, yeah. She's been hearing him in interviews forever. And so, yeah, he had like no enthusiasm behind his answers. And I just wonder if that's like his team just says to the MC, like, here's the questions you can ask. Like, here's your approved questions. That's just what I guess. But anyway, okay. Afterwards, we're leaving the panel, heading back out to the car. And we're kind of in this pretty empty hallway. And I noticed these doors open up to our left and these 2 golf carts come out. They're moving real slow. They're moving somewhere. And I see on the back of a golf cart is Hayden and Rosario. And I go, Jamie, look, there he is. And we're like 10 feet from him. And so She can't think of anything to say and just does like this awkward wave at him. He just kind of notices and gives us an awkward wave back. And oh, it was funny. So funny. It was so good. So yeah, we got this bonus experience of getting to meet him again. And it was funny because we were talking about our day as we were walking through the hallway. And she said, like, right before that, she's like, I hope he thought about me just a moment longer than everyone else. And then we got our moment right there.
Wow, perfect timing.
Yep.
Ask and you shall receive.
I don't like sand. It's coarse and rough and irritating, and it gets everywhere. Not like here. Here everything is soft and smooth.
Other things. Let's see. This, let's make this my final anime review. I have had a year of anime, watching a lot since being in Japan, because before going to Japan, I didn't watch any. And while we were there, it's like, I feel like I'm missing out on part of the experience of being here by not caring about any of this. And, you know, that was okay. It didn't hinder my experience. But as I came home, I've watched a lot in this past year. And I've talked about quite a bit. So here we go. The most recent things I've watched is Solo Leveling. Have you heard of Solo Leveling?
I have not.
It is really good. I've got no bad things to say about that. It's basically video games in real life, kind of like an MMORPG. So basically the premise is, suddenly all these portals have opened up, and these portals are basically dungeons that you would encounter in an RPG. They're full of goblins and stuff like that. And while these dungeons opened up, a bunch of people awoke, magical powers, RPG powers. And so everyone has a rank, A, B, C, D, E, oh, and S. And they're stuck at that rank. They can't get any better. And the main character, he's an E rank, but he might find a way to get better. And so it's just, it's really interesting. It's really good. Jake didn't hear any of that. The call disconnected. So I'm going to reconnect with him, and then we'll just pretend that he heard all that. So what'd you think? It sounds pretty cool, right?
Yeah, that sounds totally awesome, man. That's legit.
All right, so Solo Leveling, watch that. But then I wanted to get a little nostalgic. You know, I have watched anime before in middle school, back at the Toonami days, you know, Sailor Moon, Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z. So I haven't watched Dragon Ball since middle school, essentially. And so I finally started watching Dragon Ball Super, which is the newest iteration. And it is good, but my standards have changed. This past year of watching just really solid action anime with Jujutsu Kaisen, Hell's Paradise, Chainsaw Man, Demon Slayer, like just solid good stuff. The formula of Dragon Ball, I feel like, doesn't hold up as well anymore. It's just a lot of flying into each other, blurry fists, and energy blasts. You know, there's not a lot going on with the animation of it. I will say I'm not that far into Super, and maybe it'll change my mind. But looking back on Dragon Ball Z, like, that's how it's always been. Watching Dragon Ball Super, for those of you who've watched it, you know, it starts off with a battle against Beerus, this destruction god. And during this battle, I counted three times where they played the same animation of them charging at each other. Like, just recycled the animation. It's like, okay, this, getting a little bored of this. And the filler episodes are not very interesting either. But sorry for those of you who are Dragon Ball diehard fans. But I still enjoy it. But things have just gotten better since then. And it hasn't really adapted to that. But I could be wrong. I know there's some big bad villains coming up later. It's still like, it's like 120 episodes or more. I don't even know if it's done. Regardless, we'll see. We'll keep watching. It has been a lot of fun watching all this anime. I look forward to discovering more. I hate that there's so many good ones that I've watched that's like, there's only one season out. I have to wait. I need to look up awesome complete series so I don't have to wait for stuff like that.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, here, you know, everything's all out right away. And, you know, it's the problem is waiting for the translated version, right? Or waiting for it to just come over either with like a translation or a dub.
And you're right. Like, but actually, Crunchyroll has been pretty much day and date for a lot of the new stuff. So I watched the finale of Solo Leveling the same day it went live in Japan. I just watched it subbed.
I gotcha.
Yeah, it's not a wait for that. It's just waiting for series to be renewed and new episodes to be made.
Well, when you come over here, you can find plenty of merch related to whatever anime you want.
Yep.
Merch for.
I'm excited. I've tried to start stocking up on some anime shirts to wear over to Japan.
Nice.
Fit right in. Going weeb, full weeb.
For sure. You've never had the chance to. Now's your chance to do that. Mm-hmm. You know,
I'm also bringing a body pillow. Yep. paid for an extra plane seat.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Let's talk about all the good stuff that you can hear.
Let's move into some game talk. We don't have anything super planned. We have some questions we're gonna talk about with each other. But first off, I gotta know, where'd you end up in Mass Effect 3, man?
Not very far.
Ah!
Yeah, I know.
Why?
It's just, I don't know, man. Like, after I started that DLC at the inappropriate time and realized that this is not necessarily canon. I mean, like, yeah, it doesn't really matter, but I just kind of, I don't know, man. It's been hard to pick it back up and get that interest back, get that momentum going. It's like stopping the giant bowling ball in its tracks. It takes a bit of effort to push it again.
Yeah. You did the same thing with 2. You got into 2 and then just stopped, and then I got you playing it again, and you're like, oh, yeah, this is awesome. Why'd I stop?
Yeah. Yeah, I have to go through the whole DLC before I can get back to the main storyline.
I don't know if you have to go all the way through it, but for those of you who played Mass Effect 3 and know the wonderful Citadel DLC, Jake accidentally started it before finishing the game, which is the wrong way to do it. But I think if you just play a little bit into it, there's a point where you can leave. But I could be wrong.
Yeah.
I could, I don't know.
I've been trying to follow that like on a tutorial online, and I don't know. It's not very clear. So far, it's just been a bunch of people talking about why it shouldn't be this way and why it shouldn't be that way, as opposed to when can I stop the DLC?
Well, here's the thing. It's been long enough. You've been paused on this game so long that I don't think it'll bother you that much to reload a save that's like 4 hours back.
That's just a lot of effort, though.
Oh man, I want to talk to you about it, and I hate that we can't do an episode about it. But here's a fun story I wanted to share. My most recent playthrough in the Citadel DLC, and maybe you've came across this moment. James Vega is at your apartment, and he notices your workout room. And if you go in there, you can start doing pull-ups on the pull-up bar. And he's just like, "Nice, man. My record's 182. And you can just keep doing pull-ups where it just goes. He does this real slow pull-up where it just goes. It's probably a 4 second count on each pull-up. But then it just comes up with the triggers. Left trigger, pull-up. Right trigger, pull-up.
Uh-huh.
Left trigger. It just keeps going back and forth, back and forth. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to see what happens this time if I do 183 pull-ups. And you know what? I did it. It takes like 15 minutes just hitting the triggers. And then all you get is like, "Nice, man, you beat my record." And that's it.
No trophy, no achievement?
Nothing.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay, Easter eggs like that are wonderful and terrible at the same time.
It's just hilarious that it's there, that you can do it.
Yeah, that's true. You deserve some kind of a reward for that. I feel like there should be an achievement of some sorts.
I get to brag about it for hundreds and thousands of people to hear right now.
That's true. You got to talk about it on the air.
That's right. So many people listen to this.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
That's why we're so popular.
Exactly.
Holy hell, you did it. I don't know what to say. How you feeling?
Like I could do another 183.
Uh-huh. Whatever you say, loco. You still got it. Don't let anybody tell you different.
Don't worry. I won't.
So let's get into our first question here. What are the most innovative gameplay mechanics introduced in the recent years, you think?
Innovative gameplay mechanics. This is one that I thought a little bit about, and there's a lot to be said, I feel like, but I feel like, so as we kind of talked about in recent years, like, yeah, the technology has really evolved, but it's almost kind of plateaued to the point where, like, your graphics can only get so good before it's like, whatever. We don't look at games the same way anymore. Like, games feel a little cheaper in some regards. They don't feel as amazing when they come out or in very rare instances. But to compensate for that and make some interesting gameplay mechanic choices and I guess innovations there, I feel like one thing that's really been exciting, at least for people who play on consoles, and well, I mean, in any case, game controllers are now equipped with very, very sensitive motion capability. Sure. In the fact that, I mean, that's been a thing for a while now, but like, I'm talking about like micro vibrations that kind of mimic what you feel or what you're experiencing on screen.
Yeah. The PS5 controller specifically.
Yeah, that's definitely an innovation that I feel is extremely immersive, along with the adaptive triggers mm-hmm. and such like that. So I feel like those are really cool. I wouldn't say gimmicky, but they're definitely cool. As far as innovations, one thing that I feel like has been extremely, or I guess has a lot of potential, is the amount of accessibility that's now present in games. Specifically, the amount of customization that you can do to games now. I mean, like, customization has always been a thing in games, but you can customize everything down to the smallest control mechanism now, it seems like, and customize your gameplay experience to your specific needs or your specific wants, basically.
So you're talking accessibility features?
Accessibility features, I feel like, is probably one of the biggest innovations in gameplay these days.
Yeah, and I think that's been very noticeable in, like, first-party PlayStation games, especially.
Mm-hmm.
Where,
yeah, I think it's got a lot of potential.
You can go in and tweak so much about not just, like, the difficulty, but the way you see things. Like, if you're more vision-impaired, it'll, like, I know this is in The Last of Us, like, it'll highlight enemies for you, uh-huh. or it'll change the way things sound. And, yeah, there's been great strides to allow anyone to play basically however they want. And this does just remind me, what was your complaint about the recent relaunch of Battlefront?
Oh, yes. The recent relaunch of Battlefront is the axis switching. I play everything with flipped axes being switched on my controllers. Mm-hmm. So they did not offer that option. They botched that and offered so few options when they
launched
that game.
That's ridiculous. Like, that is,
I know,
that's an archaic option. Like,
yeah,
you can invert stuff on the N64 on Banjo-Tooie,
uh-huh.
and you can't do yep. it in this re-release of Battlefront.
I know. For like a couple weeks, it was unplayable for me. Like, I'd get on it for a few minutes and try to train myself to, you know, rethink everything that I knew. It was not working. Like, I'm just sitting, like, staring at the floor, like, moving straight up to the sky the entire time. Like, my soldier looked completely dazed and confused. Like, this is not fun. I need to wait until this patch comes out. And I went on some online forums, and there was a lot of the same complaints. They just botched that. And on top of that, the game was crashing a lot more than it should have been. So I guess we can talk about that issue a little bit later, which we've already, I think, discussed in the past. But yeah, like, things like that. Accessibility should be standard. Mm-hmm. And it's becoming a lot more standard. On top of that, the amount of customization that you can do with games for your own experience. Like, there, a lot of games are now eliminating difficulty-based achievements because, you know, everyone plays differently, and not everyone's going to, you know, be able to achieve a certain amount of whatever you're used to. So I feel like it's now about kind of like putting more of the time into it as opposed to putting the certain skill into it. Does that make sense? That's what's kind of happening now with games.
Yeah. So I have a question for you about easy mode.
Mm-hmm.
How has your thoughts changed on using easy mode now versus high school, college, Jake?
I guess now I feel like it's an option that I want to have.
Yeah.
Because if I play through a game multiple times, I don't always want it to be the hardest thing in the world. Like, mm-hmm. I want to sometimes play a game where I can pay more attention to the story. You know, have a relaxing playthrough, especially right. if I've already beaten it. In college, I wanted the hardest mode possible. Like, I always wanted games to be hard.
Yeah, but I also feel like there's a social aspect to it. Like, if in high school, everyone's playing a game, right? Everyone's, because that's how it goes. In high school, everyone kind of plays the same game. And if it came out that, like, everyone has beat this game on normal or harder and you beat it on easy, you're going to get crap for that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That was a thing, wasn't it? Like, yeah, we used to brag about what mode we beat it on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there would even be times where I'd lie and say, like, yeah, I beat it on hard mode. And of course I didn't. But, like, yeah, that's the thing. It wasn't about, it shouldn't be about the difficulty that you played it on. Sometimes you just want to enjoy the story, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like, I guess the modern age of gaming is going to be a lot more open to, you know, everyone's individual preferences and abilities with games.
I ask because I have done it recently twice. And it kind of bothers me that I have. So I'll first start off and say that I did it with God of War Ragnarok, where I started playing it normal, but also, the combat just never quite clicked for me. It wasn't as fluid as I guess I wanted, but it's also, it's too dang long of a game. I complained about that in the last episode where I just, it's just like, come on, let's get this plot moving. And so, I bumped it down to easy just because I wanted to get it over with, really. As good as it was, it was just too slow. But more recently, I have got on the hype train of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth coming out, having never played a Final Fantasy before. And so I started with Final Fantasy VII Remake, which has been out for like 4 years now. And it's good. The combat is solid. And Final Fantasy Remake, if you haven't played it, it definitely has like some old school PS2 jank to it that is actually kind of endearing, where you feel kind of nostalgic playing it because it's like, oh, this is really pretty, but it feels like this came out a long time ago. But that game, I understood the combat for the most part. I mean, there's some areas I could improve on, but the way it's made up, especially with big boss fights, is they don't seem to be made to beat the first time. You're supposed to learn all their move sets and understand when you need to dodge, when you need to do certain moves. And I was getting to this point where a lot of boss fights, like, okay, I was doing okay, but they're taking a while. And like 10 or 15 minutes in, when I finally got them on the ropes, they do like this one-shot move where I wasn't prepared for. It's like, oh my gosh, what a waste of time. So now I got to play it over again. Hope I learned how to read that one shot is coming and then take care of it. And it's like, I get it. I get that these are made to not win the first time, because that's part of the strategy, is to understand the boss. And so I played through, let's see, for those of you who played it, I beat Hell House on normal. And then when I got to this ghost boss out in like that ghost train junkyard, he one-shotted me. I'm just like, no, screw this. I'm not going to just keep replaying this fight. I just want to move on. So from that point on, I played the rest of the game on easy. And I don't care that I did. I enjoyed it. Like, because, you know, Final Fantasy is all about weird story and characters. And that's really all I wanted to see. And also, as I got near the end, there's so many enemies that just are just spongy, even on easy. And I was thinking, like, man, if I was on normal right now, I would be so sick of these enemies. So all that to say, I'm kind of worried about when I finally go into Rebirth, because I'm kind of saving that for my summer game, because that's like an 80-hour game. And it's much more open world. And it's like, do I want to try to play that on normal? Will I just get bored playing such a long game on easy? I don't know. We'll see. But regardless, it's a really good game.
It's good. It's so wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. What do you guys think about playing on easy? I mean, it really depends on the game.
Yeah, it does.
So let me backtrack here. Our original question was innovative gameplay mechanics. Yeah. And the way I think about that is mechanics that kind of changed games that came after it. So if you look at Resident Evil 4, the over-the-shoulder shooter, right? It was kind of the first one. And then a bunch of games replicated that afterwards.
Yeah.
Look at Gears of War, the cover shooter.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of cover stuff started happening after that. Look at Mass Effect 2 and 3.
Hmm.
I think more recently, maybe it's like the Dark Souls or something, the roll around and attack with the triggers games. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? We attack with the right and left trigger and bumpers.
Yep.
A lot have started doing that. I do not like it, especially coming off of playing Spider-Man, because Spider-Man is still all on the buttons. It's very quick, reflexive gameplay, while now everything is, it's much more, like sometimes it's fast-paced, but it's more of a slow pace of learning the parries, the blocks, the counters, and much more deliberate. And I don't like that. But I haven't really invested in, I've never played a Dark Souls, if that's where this is all coming from. But even, like, look at Horizon. Horizon is all on the triggers now, too. So,
yeah.
How do you feel about that? And do you think there's been any other mechanics like that that have kind of been bleeding into newer games?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Honestly, I like it on Horizon. It works really well because...
It does. I got used to it in Horizon.
And honestly, it's not really bothered me that much. I feel like... I think as controllers are going to be getting fancier, we're just going to start seeing a lot of fancier things. I feel personally like we're just going to be seeing a lot more gimmicks in the near future. Like stuff that might seem really fun or interesting or unique may or may not work, but we're going to be seeing a lot more gimmicks just for the sake of spicing things up.
Sure.
Yeah, utilizing buttons for sure and doing the kind of thing of like almost making it into a rhythm game, if you will. Like where it has to be a certain pattern.
And that's how a lot of things are. And like that's, I kind of struggled with that with God of War because it's trigger based, but then it's trying to learn the rhythm of all the fights. And I just couldn't quite get it. I couldn't understand the counters very well in that game. But anyway.
Well, and maybe just because maybe that's a little bit of, it's not kind of what we're used to. It's not kind of what we were raised on. It's something new. It's something that's just taking a little extra time to get used to. And that's actually something I wanted to mention earlier is that's one of the reasons why I like to play games on easier modes now, because I'm tired of having to master the new system of whatever this game's introducing.
Yeah. I hate learning systems.
Exactly. Like if it was even all across the board, that would be great, but it's not. And you have to learn a new one to master a game on a harder difficulty. There's more games now. If it's easier, I don't have to do that. And I don't have to forget and like search my memory banks for a different profile of a different game. Okay. How did this game work? Oh yeah. This game had this combination to do this. This one did that. It takes a while to get that back in your head once you've been used to this particular one for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just probably a product of how many games there are now and how easy it is to make games and buy them, unfortunately. Have access to them, I'll say
that. Yeah, easy access for sure. Well, I think we answered that question. So let's move on.
Yes.
Next question here. And this is a big one. What are some of the best examples of storytelling in games? And can you give an example of why? Like, what makes that game stand out as a storyteller?
Best examples of storytelling in games. I feel like we've talked about this in some regards, but my rule of thumb is a good story is one that not only hooks your audience, but they can actually remember. So it's easy to get an audience's attention. It's easy to hook an audience with, you know, cheap thrills. It's difficult to have something linger and last with them, or at least make an impact. Like, the first thing that came to my mind is BioShock, series BioShock, right? And that's held its own. I mean, yeah, some of the gameplay mechanics have been a little bit dated, but think about the story. We don't remember what it was like to pick up that weapon and use it this way, or how we, you know, use this particular atom in this way. We remember the story of it. We remember the atmosphere. We remember the characters. We remember the big twist at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I think BioShock, I don't think running around, you know, getting splicers. I think about, you know, rescuing the little sister and realizing who Andrew Ryan actually is. And what was that game? Something different.
Yeah. And so I'll piggyback on part of what you said there, and that was atmosphere. And I think that's a big part of it for games that want to tell story is how do you use the environment to hook players to cause them to want to explore, but also to be learning more things about the world as they explore. And there's a mechanic right there. It was one of the first to really do audio diaries right. And then after that, a bunch of games started having audio diaries. But these, I think, were really interesting at explaining such a strange world, but also in just what you saw. It was just such a detail-rich environment that just made you ask, like, dang, what happened here? What is this place? And, I mean, it's a prime example. And it might be hard to think of other examples as high as BioShock, but it nailed environmental storytelling.
Yes, or in this case, it riveted. Sorry, anyway.
I'd say it drilled it.
It drilled it, ha ha ha. just kind of talking about what you did there, or what you talked about there, think of it this way. How many games that you have that are set in like modern times? Too many. How many are set in the medieval fantasy era? Too many. We've seen castles. We've seen modern buildings. You know, we've seen skyscrapers. We've seen outer space. When was the last time we saw, under the ocean, a crumbling Art Deco city that's just sitting there, filled with very strange divers protecting little girls?
it's very, very unique.
So there's that. And on top of that, it's crumbling. It's falling apart. It makes you ask why, right? So first off, we've got this atmosphere that we've never seen before, of course, and then it's falling apart and being controlled by these like zombies, essentially. And then you want to ask why, and then you find an audio diary. This is going to tell us why.
So can you think of another game that it does something similar?
Or it does something similar?
This is the pinnacle.
Yeah, this is the pinnacle, isn't it? I guess... Now, BioShock is a really, really good example, isn't it? Another example that I thought of was Shadow of the Colossus, but that is a different type, I feel like. That game, it almost is intended to not answer your questions. It's intended to get your attention, of course, but it's never specific or clear enough to ever answer your questions, and I think that's intentional. Like, it's always going to have you asking why. It's always going to have you asking, what happened? What's the background? You'll never know, but you can always guess. And it wants you to draw your own conclusions. And some games are like that. And some games are meant to be like that. And that way, you're always talking about it.
Yeah.
It's like prehistoric archaeology. We'll never know the answers, but we'll always have questions. And we'll always be asking questions. We'll always be making predictions. Mm-hmm. That's another example of good storytelling done right, I think.
Yeah, because there's... weight to what you're doing. You don't necessarily understand why you're doing it, and it's just beautiful at the same time. So yeah, that's a very quiet game in regards of story. It's like you said, it's what they're not telling you that makes it so interesting. So I'd say the opposite, instead of using environment, though, you know, graphically The Last of Us has beautiful environments in that, but that is a character driven drama, really. I mean, look how well it adapted to TV, because it was so cinematic to begin with, but just so, I mean, that was so well written. And that's almost, it's almost not fair to talk about some of these modern games, because it's actually kind of so easy now in terms of getting real life actors and motion capture and just beautiful scores, while older games had much less at their disposal in terms of emotional manipulation, I guess what I'm trying to say. So I know you want to talk about The Last of Us, but let's look back a little further. Look at Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask. Those games have really good story. But when you think about it technically, it's not like that much happened in those games. But with the technology that they had, they were still able to add emotion with sound, with brief interactions with these people. but then tight gameplay to kind of wrap it all together. Yeah. So I guess I'm not sure what point I'm trying to make with that, but I think it was a lot harder back then. And yeah, objectively now, if that game came out now, like let's say Breath of the Wild has no story to it. It's got like no interesting story. But maybe back then on the N64, it would have seemed more incredible story-wise. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know what my point was there.
Well, I think you answered your question right there. We're talking about innovative ways that storytelling has been used. And Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask did something that no other game had done at the time. They introduced not only new gameplay systems like the C targeting system and the C item slot system,
sure,
which worked really well. Mm-hmm. A, that's a hook that gets you into the game. But you are now into this, you're now thrust into this story. Like, for instance, Super Mario 64, what is it? It's very, very simple.
Yeah.
Okay, Princess was captured. Find the stars to save her. Okay, think about the story with Ocarina of Time. It's got so many layers, so many characters, and it's over a very, very long period of time from kid to adult.
Yeah.
And things change very differently between those two eras. So think about how much happens and where you go and the variety of locations in that game. And yeah, it's relatively small compared to modern games, but it's almost like it was the first time we were seeing a game like this. I mean,
yeah,
you could seamlessly walk between areas. It wasn't like you were jumping into a painting and going to another world. This whole world was connected. You know, mm-hmm. You're in the same world this whole time. And that makes it a little more palatable, a little more realistic in a way.
Yeah, well, and I think both of them have such good villains of, there's just kind of this dread kind of hanging over the game. It was especially, mm-hmm. and literally, in Majora's Mask, but also just the threat of Ganondorf in Ocarina of Time, seeing the castle in the background, seeing the decay of Castletown, and just the kind of the despair that you feel. And it drives that desire to win, to be the savior, so much more than collecting power stars.
Yep, absolutely. It's a lot deeper when you're walking back into a castle town that you just briefly, you know, were in hours before and realizing it's now in ruins. Like, oh my gosh,
I
remember way back when this was nice and there was a bazaar here and there was a game show.
Jolly. Before then it is re-deads.
It's re-deads. Yeah, exactly. So it's like that kind of, you're making attachments during the game that are taken away from you. It makes the timeline feel a lot longer than it actually is. So when you do beat it, it's like, how long have I spent with this game? Way too long. No, not really that long. It's not a long game. It's just, it makes it feel like it's a long game because so much happens.
All right, so as we come near the end here, who knows how much further this episode has. We might talk about this part for a while. We haven't done a top five in a while. And thank you for everyone who has sent in voice clips and emails in preparation for the finale. But one in particular, Drew Rapp. Hey, Drew, how you doing? Part of his email, he said how much he enjoyed the top five list. And I was like, oh, man. I don't think we've done one in quite a few episodes, so let's do one. And especially talking about storytelling-rich games. Some of our answers aren't story-based here, but I want to know, what are our top five just like magical moments in gaming? The parts that are our core memories that just made us love gaming so much and remember these wonderful games. So how's that sound?
It sounds wonderful. I'm excited to talk about this. This was a hard list, I'll just say up front.
It was so hard. As we're speaking, I'm sure you're going to tell me some. I'm going to be like, oh, crap, that's way better than what I put. But we've got years and years of these gaming memories. It is so hard to narrow down. So naturally, mine are probably some of the more recent ones. But I've got some runner-ups we can talk about, too. So why don't you kick us off, Jake? What's your number five most beautiful, memorable moment?
My number five most beautiful, memorable moments. Some of these I did make a little bit general just to kind of collectively bring some more memories together. But one that really stuck out with me was when I played Assassin's Creed for the first time, and two parts in particular. The first time I was in the Animus and went back in time, and the first time I synchronized my memory with a giant tall building or whatever. This was before it was kind of
a Ubisoft staple.
Before it became a Ubisoft staple and kind of a joke now, that was a neat thing to find these, you know, tall areas, these buildings that are each one of them probably based on an actual one in real life in some regard. But the first time I did that, and it just, the camera sort of panned around and I saw the eagles flying and this kind of deep choral music played in the background. And then I just felt the sense of like, wow. I just unlocked something that was based on real life at some point. This is an actual history moment. And then it cuts the sound effect of the Animus or whatever. And then I jump down into the hay. That stuck out with me for some weird reason. And I remember feeling like, in a sense, I have stepped into the future of gaming. it was almost like symbolic in the fact that Altair was stepping in to the past, I was stepping into the future. This is different and unique.
That's deep.
Compared to, yeah, exactly. This is very unique to what I've been playing in the past. Because prior to you giving me your old Xbox, I was only playing Wii games. So I was playing like Wii Play and Wii Fit. And then this happened. So that was a magical moment for me.
Yeah, that's solid. So my number five is a more recent one, and maybe I'll think of a better one. But regardless, the ending of Superliminal really resonated with me. And I have talked about this already on the show. If you've not played Superliminal, it is on Game Pass, on PC at least, or it's cheap on Steam. It is just a wonderful puzzle game. But at the end, it makes you feel just so good. And I can't explain it. I don't want to explain it because I want you to experience it for yourself. But it just made me so happy. And I really kind of want to go replay this right now. I think it's been long enough. I've probably forgotten some of the puzzles.
It'll also make you love and hate Dr. Glenn Pierce.
Glenn Pierce rocks all the way through. I don't know what you're talking about. Why would you hate Glenn Pierce?
I don't know. He's keeping you in the dark here. He's keeping you in the dark. But on the same token, he's almost like pushing you forward, motivating you.
Exactly.
Even though he'll never reveal himself to you.
What if you are Glenn Pierce?
Whoa, hold on. So like I was as if your character is talking the whole time.
Yeah.
Like walking. Hello, my name is Dr. Glenn Pierce. Like you're talking to yourself.
Mean,
holy cow, man.
The whole thing's a dream, and that's part of the first thing you can learn in the game. That's not a spoiler. So maybe it's like just your own subconscious speaking to you, guiding you throughout the game.
Wow. And at the very end where he's suddenly extremely positive and uplifting.
Or negative. I don't know.
Or
don't
negative.
Spoil it. Anyway, go on.
Deep. All right. Yes. Good game. I did play that a few weeks ago, actually.
And did you?
I did. Well, I didn't play all the way through, but I did kind of mess with it a bit.
Oh, you punk. Play it all the way through.
Okay, you're right. So, next one is BioShock. Getting out of the bathysphere for the first time.
Ding, ding, ding. It's on my list.
Cool. We talked about this a little bit, but I don't think I need to explain why, because we just did a few minutes ago, and you understand, Cameron.
Is it someone new?
Yes, exactly. Is it someone new? Would you kindly something something? I think the very
wrench.
Twist at the end. Yeah. Twist at the end was also part of why this was magical for me. But just playing this game throughout and realizing that it is a realistic setting. I mean, yeah, it's obviously not, but it's based around realism. It's based around an actual time period.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing the remnants of everyday life that were very similar to a lifestyle that was present in modern society, you know, 70 years ago.
Yeah.
It felt very real to me. And on top of that, you're, you know, fighting enemies that were once humans who were rational.
Yeah.
So it all felt very real. And that's what contributed to the magic of it.
Yeah, you're right in that. You can just say BioShock. Like, it's so broad. There's so much memorable stuff about it. But for why it's on my list is specifically the intro. Finding the lighthouse in the middle of the ocean. And as you go down into the bathysphere and then the shutters open, rapture. It is just awe-inspiring. And it's set
it's up rapture.
So well. It's wonderful. And so I actually put Rapture / Columbia on this because I think they reveal Columbia just as well, even though it's the same thing. It's like it's almost the same scene. They still do it so beautifully.
It's so, like a polar opposite, though.
It is.
If you think about it.
Hallelujah. Ascension.
Yes.
So combine both those together. They're number two on my list. I just really, really love that intro.
Wonderful.
So my number four, which you cannot relate to, is Mass Effect 3. In particular, just the tension I felt the first time I played this, because there is a weight to it. Kind of like what we said with storytelling in the Zelda games. But there is this weight hanging over you of the Reapers. The game starts where the Reapers have arrived at Earth and are just wrecking Earth. And so your whole adventure is trying to recruit help to prevent this thing that's already happening, as you're seeing just like genocide happen across the galaxy. And every thing you do, even though you're making progress throughout the game, you still just feel like, I don't know how I'm going to stop this. I don't understand how this game can end with me on top. It just kept me so invested. And that's how I play Mass Effect. Mass Effect, especially 2 and 3, I always play them back to back. I just feel like I'm living in those games when I'm playing them. Like, I'm just a part of that world. And I always feel sad afterwards that it's like, I'm not really a part of it. It was all the journey along the way. So, yes. Mass Effect 3, just in general, but yeah, especially just what you feel, the hopelessness and just wonderful story throughout that game. And maybe that's one awesome. Day you'll experience it too.
I'd like to. I should. But I completely agree with your statement. It's been a great game so far until I ruined my experience and stopped that with the DLC, which should not be the case.
It should not.
All right. So, Mass Effect. Good choice. Number three on my list is the Forest Temple from Ocarina of Time.
Oh, yeah.
And I think we might have talked about this a long, long time ago, but this stands out as a magical moment. I don't really know the exact reasons why yet, but it just was. And for some reason, that temple really stuck with me, and it has over the years. It was the environment, the very eerie music, the very eerie atmosphere, the fact that it looks like it was a mansion that was once inhabited, and the ghosts are named after the characters from that book, Little Women. I don't know, just everything kind of combined to make this atmosphere I've never seen replicated in any other of the Zelda games. Like, it's completely its own thing. On top of that, it is your first experience as adult Link in a like serious area, and it gives you this sense of, I'm not a kid anymore. This is real life. This is the real tough stuff. You take two steps in, two wolfuses attack you right off the bat. Like, oh my gosh, I these were mini bosses when I was a kid, and now I have to fight two of them. Wow. So yeah. It's just this transition and the weight that it carried with that. All of a sudden, I'm not getting spiritual stones. I'm getting medallions. I'm on the actual quest now to stop Ganondorf and save Zelda. So that was it. And I remember I wanted a soundtrack of Ocarina of Time specifically for the Forest Temple music.
Yeah.
Because I liked listening to it. And I would just sit there and listen to it at times. And I didn't get that until way, way, way later, because none of them had that music on it, but oh well.
Oh, it's funny how technology has changed. You couldn't listen to music just whenever you wanted to. I remember two circumstances. I wanted to hear I'm Blue. I'm Blue, da ba dee da da. You know, great, great song. And it was like on MTV where it was like TRL was the show where they play music videos. And I'd be watching it. It's like, yes, all right, it got the boat. We're going to watch the Blue music video. And then it'd start playing. But then it just cuts to like interviewing people in the studio, like in the bottom corner. And it's like they're just talking over the video. It's like, what is this? This is awful.
Oh, my gosh.
Nickelodeon did something similar, I'm pretty sure. And I wanted to see the Aaron's Party music video by Aaron Carter. And it kept like losing the vote and I couldn't get to see it. Now I can just type it in right now. Aaron's Party. Oh, here it is.
Wow. Instant everything.
Instant gratification for sure. You want to hear a weird fact to make us feel older?
Absolutely.
So Ocarina of Time in this year, 2024, the Ocarina of Time 3DS remake is now as old as Ocarina of Time was when the 3D version came out.
Wow.
Because it came out in like 2011, I want to say. Yeah, 2011, which was 13 years ago, while the previous came out in 98, which was 13 years before that.
So the years just keep rolling by.
The years start coming and they don't stop coming.
Hey now.
Somebody.
All right.
It's funny.
Well, my number three, I'll piggyback off your Zelda, and let's talk about Wind Waker. Now,
okay.
I know you played into this quite a bit, but you were playing on the Japanese version, and maybe everything wasn't quite clicking the same for you. But the moment for me is when you descend from the top of the ocean down into Hyrule that's been like frozen in time underwater. It is a very interesting, trippy experience of everything is like in black and white, and all the enemies that are patrolling are just like frozen in time. For me, I thought it was a very strange experience because it was the first Zelda I played. I had known a lot about Ocarina of Time, but since I never played it, it just felt like this weird, distant memory, dream or something where when I descended and saw that Hyrule, because I think it's supposed to be the Hyrule from Ocarina of Time under the ocean, and to see it and be like, here's this game I never played. I should have played it, and now it's too late. It's here, and it's ruined. And it just kind of has this haunting music that plays there, and it's just such a pivotal moment in the game. It's where you get the Master Sword. And I'm doing my best to try to describe it, but it hit me. It was a very emotional moment in Wind Waker, an already great game, but just an awesome moment.
Wow.
And do you remember that? Did you get that far?
I don't recall it, honestly. But that sounds pretty deep and awesome.
It was deep. It was at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, it was deep. Very nice.
All right, number two, Jake.
My number two is booting up Mystical Ninja starting Goemon for the first time. And specifically because without that game, I would not be here in Japan right now. I credit my entire fascination with Japan around that game and discovering an entirely new culture I'd never seen or heard about just by turning on a game based on medieval Japan around these ninjas who are trying to save the world. Ever since then, I've been into Japan and I flipped that game on and just felt this amazement of wow, what is this place? I've never seen this place before. Oh, it's real? It's Japan? Wait a second. I want to see this place in real life. 25 years ago-ish.
Yeah.
The rest is history.
That's cool.
So
I know nothing about that game.
Well,
maybe I should.
You know everything about it now. You know everything you need to now.
It's inspiring for sure.
Definitely inspiring. And yesterday, actually, when I was out viewing the cherry blossoms, there was a stall selling hanami dango. And those are the, like, it's like small sweet rice balls that you just eat while looking at the cherry blossoms. And that was a form of getting health in that game.
I had to
pick these up. So every time I see them, I think, Goemon.
Get that health.
Yes, I was thinking about buying some, but then I thought, nah, if I just eat a bunch, I'll probably just get, like, diabetes or something.
That's true, I guess.
Yeah, all right. A little more realistic. You can't get health eating those. They're a little too sweet and a little too filling.
I gotcha. With that, my number two, as we covered, was the introduction to Rapture. So, Jake, take us to your number one.
My number one is beating Super Mario 64 for the first time.
Oh, my gosh. That should have been on my list. The theme song, or the end credits.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. It's so
now
good.
Now it's going to be stuck in your head. But this was, I think, the first game I ever beat. And because of that, I was incredibly excited, and I realized I don't have to get 120 stars to beat the game. I just need to beat Bowser. And that's exactly what I did. And there was this sense of sheer euphoria that I went and I shared it with my family. I beat Mario. I beat Mario. Because they were already tired of me playing that game anyway. This was excited. And I think my dad got excited for me and was like, oh my gosh, Jake beat Mario. Something like that. I told all my friends at school. They were all happy about it because they hadn't beaten it yet.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great time.
Yeah, I 100% agree and understand. Beating the last Bowser was a hard fight. Dodging his electric rings, he covers that arena in fire breath. But then also as it starts to fall apart and take that star shape. And I remember trying and trying. And there was this time I did it. And I think my sister was watching where I spun Bowser, launched him. He hits the third bomb and dies. But in the excitement or something, I fell off the level. So as he's as he's bouncing on his back, I fall off and just wanted to cry. It's like, that took me so long. But I eventually did it. And the satisfaction of getting that giant superstar, power star, is so good.
Yeah, it was quite amazing, wasn't it? That was a good time. A simpler time, I should say.
It was a simpler time. So I will... once again, piggyback off that. We've had a similar line of thinking. For my number one, I just put Super Mario 64. But specifically, what stood out to me was, you know, I don't really know or remember what my video game experience was before Super Mario 64. Like, maybe I had played a little classic Mario on someone's Super Nintendo or something. But this in particular, and I remember being at my cousin Josh's house. He had the N64, and just being in the castle was enough for me. It just felt unreal. It's like, this is the most beautiful place I've ever seen. These blue, cloudy walls, this cool tiled floor, and then going into the rooms and seeing all the pictures, but specifically the room, not the level itself, but the room for Jolly Roger Bay. Seeing the aquarium and just the peaceful blue hue of that, it's just like, I want to be here. And all the while, we've got inside the castle walls, the theme music playing. I don't think any game or experience will ever recapture that. And that is nostalgia. That is, I guess, what we've been getting at here. The fact that we talk about all these memories that we can never actually recreate. And nostalgia's kind of sad, but it makes us happy. Where you're thinking about the simpler time where you had no worries, right? But I've been trying to change my mindset about nostalgia, because we think about things and be like, yeah, we had no worries there. And whether or not you acknowledge that that's what you like about nostalgia, that's something that we all kind of subconsciously know is like, times were simple. And mm-hmm. I'd like to argue that we're always in the good old days. So, sorry, that's a quote from The Office where Andy says,
I wish there was a way to know you're in the good old days before you've actually left them. Someone should write a song about that.
And the problem is, we're always anxious, especially as we're getting older, and maybe, you know, some more than others. But there's always things going on in our heads. But when we look back at the time, our memories have nothing to be anxious about, right? I especially have noticed this on the trips we've taken. There's a lot of times on our trips, I am very anxious about, are we going to get where we need to go on time? What kind of people are we going to be around? Is this a dangerous area? Things like that. But in hindsight, I only remember the thing that we did because it all worked out, right? I'm here. I'm alive. It went well.
Yeah.
And so in our memories, in these nostalgic memories, we don't remember actually the things that we were thinking about at that time. We only remember the happiness that it ultimately brought. And I encourage us all to think about things that way. Yes, we have anxieties, but we'll be okay. We will be able to get through it, and we'll be able to look back at it and be like, oh yeah, things were good. And I know that is not the case for everyone. Some of us, including myself, have had very little to worry about in life, but there's always good to be found. I guess that is what I'm trying to say. There's always something to look back on and be happy about. At least I really, really hope so. As a teacher, I know I'm more fortunate than I could have ever realized. And I'm sure you've seen that too in some of our students' lives. And so, yes, maybe I'm being a little hypocritical in what I'm saying, but I hope things go well for all of you listening, and that even if they're not going great right now, that you can still find things to be happy about and thankful for as you look back on. So that came out of nowhere. I was not planning on saying any of that. Super Mario 64. Beautiful. Great nostalgia.
I think what you said was very relevant, though. Absolutely.
Yeah, and like I said, that's the whole point of this podcast.
Yeah.
To be happy about the memories. And it's ironic. I don't know if it's ironic. I misuse that word. We started this podcast for the sake of nostalgia and staying in contact. But now, even though it's only been 4 years, I'm nostalgic for the beginning of this podcast. Remembering those days where, you know, the beginning of the show was very different. It was us being like, all right, what game are we going to talk about next week? Banjo-Kazooie? All right, we're going to play Banjo-Kazooie this week and then talk mm-hmm. about things next week. And so I miss having that reason to dig out those old games and then to like talk about our fresh thoughts together. And we haven't done that in a long time. We haven't been able to do that because we don't have those games anymore. So it's just interesting. You know, it started talking about nostalgia, but I now fondly look back at the start of that.
Yeah, for sure. It's amazing how that happens. We're doing this a while and now I'm starting to feel the same way. Especially now that we're coming to the end, you know?
Yeah, coming to the end. So I think that leads nicely to my runner-up. Next week is episode 128, which 128 is significant to the GameCube because that was kind of a, I don't know if it was like an inside joke or like code name or, you know, we had the N64, so surely the next thing is going to be the Nintendo 128. And that even came back. It was like a demo at E3 that had like 128 Marios running around, and then they put it in Super Smash Bros. Melee as a challenge ready to fight 128 Marios. So 128 is the GameCube. And so my runner-up is very broad, and I just wanted to talk about the GameCube and the games that came out on there because, you know, the GameCube for us, that was like, you know, that was us taking ownership of being gamers. N64 was great, but it was a lot of things being bought for us, being very determined by parents and birthdays. And not to say that that still wasn't the case with GameCube, but it was us being much more aware of the gaming industry and what we were buying and being really excited about games before they came out. All that to say, the launch of the GameCube was such a big deal. And the generational technological jump from the N64 was insane. It is so much more beautiful in all the games that came out on that. And so really just every game, it was like a sequel to the N64, and yet it looked so much more beautiful. We had Mario Kart Double Dash looking so much better than Mario Kart 64. Same with Sunshine and Super Mario 64 and so on. Super Smash Bros. Melee, like that, those leaps and bounds better than what came before it. So it was just a really exciting time to be a gamer. And once again, the call dropped. Jake didn't hear any of that. So let's get reconnected. I just went on this GameCube rant and you enjoyed it, right?
Yeah, it was great. It was a great discussion. Yeah, it was wonderful.
So next week, we're going to talk more about the GameCube in honor of episode 128 as we end things. So with that, this has been the penultimate, not the ultimate pen, but the second to last episode of Region Unlocked, which is a little sad, but also exciting.
Been a wonderful, wonderful journey. I'm looking forward to concluding it wonderfully.
Well, what else to say? What to say? If you want to send us a message, there's not much time left, but you can at regionunlockedpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram. And you know what? Even when this show's over, I will still try to post things that are relevant to games and to Jake and I on Instagram. And so you can keep following. We'll keep living through there. But
for sure.
Until then, my name's Cameron.
And my name's Jake.
And have a week full of awesome pins.
Haha. So, 最後から2番目 の さよなら. Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing somewhere beyond the sea. She's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing. It's far beyond the stars. We'll be beyond the sea.